I like the story of the man who knew his wife's birthday was coming up, and she didn't quite know what to get her, and he'd been worried over it. It was a significant birthday. And then his prayers were answered, because he heard his wife saying to one of her friends, "Oh, I wish I could be 8 again." Problem solved. Day of her birthday, he woke her up, bowl of Cocoa Pops. There you are, darling. Put your trainers on, we're off to Alton Towers. And off to Alton Towers they went. They went on every ride going. The Nesimus, the Oblivion, you name it, they were on it. Up and down, fantastic. If it span around and went in the air, they experienced it. On the way home, McDonald's for a Happy Meal. Extra fries and a large Coke. Eventually they arrive late at home. The husband and wife collapse on the bed. Feeling pleased with himself, he said, "Darling, how does it feel to be 8 again?" To which she replied, "Oh, you idiot. I meant my dress size." Sometimes we have the best intentions, but we get it all wrong. And there were two people, two followers of Jesus in the Bible, who had good intentions, but they got it all wrong. James and John, their nicknames were Sons of Thunder. I mean, what kind of character do you have to be to have a nickname, Sons of Thunder? You could kind of imagine them with leather jackets and in the back in studs, Sons of Thunder. Well, James and John were rough-cut guys, colourful characters. They would not back away in a confrontation. I think they could be aggressive, and they were certainly very, very insensitive. And when Jesus spoke about his impending death, they only had one question in their minds. Can we be number 2 and number 3 when you get to heaven? It's like someone saying to me, "Oh, I've had bad news from the doctors. Next week I'm going to die." And I say, "Oh, good. Can I have your car? Don't need it anymore, do you?" That's how insensitive their question was to Jesus. Jesus is talking about his impending death in 15 hours' time, like a slab of meat he'll be nailed to a cross and left. And all they can think about is, "Can I be number 2 and can I be number 3 when you get to heaven, when you set up your kingdom?" James and John had to learn that discipleship, following Jesus, is different to living in the world. In the world, you tread on people to get to the top. But Jesus taught, in his kingdom, you go down to get up. You go down to get up. It's as you serve others, so you are lifted up in God's sight. The very opposite. And I want to divide this passage under a number of headings. Number 1. What Jesus knew. What Jesus knew. Story told of a traveller who was going through forest on a horseback, and as he rode through the woods, he suddenly came across an oak tree that was quite oddly shaped. And he thought to himself, "Do you know what? If I was the owner of this forest, I would chop that down. It's a bit of a spoiler. It's old. It's crooked. It doesn't do justice to the other trees around this forest." And off he went. And later on, as he galloped through several fields, he turned back to look at his where he'd come from. And suddenly the thing that dominated the landscape was the very oak tree that earlier on he would have said, "I'd cut down." Suddenly he saw its beauty and its significance. And I guess with hindsight, we often, the immediate situation can be lost. And it's only as we look back, we get a bigger or a fuller picture. And that's true in this story here. The disciples see only in part, but Jesus had a bigger picture in mind. In fact, there are 3 things Jesus knew. First of all, he knew about God's timing. The time had come, we read. That's an expression that John uses again and again. The hour has come. All the way through the gospel, "My time has not yet come," said Jesus. His hour had not yet come. Again and again and again and again and again. What time? What hour? Jesus knew the very reason he was born into the world wasn't just to give us a new batch of teaching. We had the whole of the Old Testament. We got the rest of the New Testament. God could have given us good Bible teaching through other people. It wasn't just to do incredible miracles. The miracles are throughout the Old Testament. They're there throughout the New Testament. Admittedly, the miracles Jesus did were quite special, raising the dead. But again, the Apostle Paul, brought back to life someone who had died. So his prime purpose wasn't to teach or to do spectacular miracles. His prime purpose in coming was to die. Here was one born to die. You and I, when we were born to live. But he was born to die. And of course, in a few weeks' time, as Christmas approaches, we'll remember the baby who was born, but his birth, in every sense, is linked to his death. Even in the gifts, they brought him gold because he was a king, frankincense because he was a priest, and they brought myrrh, a burial spice. Why do you bring the burial spice to a baby full of life? Because here's one who was born to die. And Jesus here is not clock watching. His brow is not knit in anxiety. He's not looking nervously back and forward. He's in total control. He's calm. He knows that within 15 hours, the reason he was born will happen. And he's prepared. There's a book called Miracle on the River Kwai. Some of you may have seen the film Bridge on the River Kwai. And the book, The Miracle of the River Kwai, is a true story of some Scottish soldiers during the Second World War who were taken by their Japanese captors and forced to build a jungle railroad. Under the strain of imprisonment, the group disintegrated. Everyone was at each other's throats. It was survival. Dog eat dog. There was no unity amongst the prisoners. There was no affection. There was no love. There was just hostility. If someone had some extra food and you could take it, you took it. You didn't care about anyone else. Survival was the key. Ernest Gordon tells the story of how the prisoners one day were lined up by their Japanese guards and they were told at the checkpoint a shovel was missing. Return the shovel now or you will all be shot. Nobody moved. Everyone panicked, looking at each other. Who's taken a shovel? Put it back quickly. Someone bring it out. No one did. All of a sudden, one soldier stood forward and they shot him. And they moved on to their next checkpoint. This time when they counted the shovels, there was one extra shovel for the man who was dead. No one had stolen a shovel. They had miscounted. But one man, for the sake of his companions, was prepared to step out and sacrifice his life so that they might live. And Ernest Gordon says that act of sacrifice transformed the whole group. From now on, it wasn't dog eat dog survival. From now on, they cared and they supported and they looked after one another. One man's sacrifice changed the whole group in a far greater way. The sacrifice, the death of Jesus. Yes, it was on behalf of other people, a sinful world. And yes, it was to transform the lives of people who couldn't care about God. Jesus knew about his time. Secondly, he knew about Judas. The evening meal was in progress, and Jesus knew who would betray him. Jesus didn't make a mistake choosing Judas Iscariot. You know, when Jesus saw Simon Peter, he said, "Simon, you're going to be a rock." He knew all about him and what he could be. And when Jesus allowed Judas to be part of his group, he wasn't taken by surprise. He knew he was a man corrupted by greed. And the New Testament reveals him as a money-motivated individual who looked after the treasure bag and helped himself and was prepared to sell even his own master to get 30 more silver coins. Jesus wasn't taken by surprise. This was part of a plan being fulfilled. And thirdly, he knew all things had been given to him, verse 3. He had come from God and he was returning to God. Nobody like Jesus. Not a messenger or a prophet. The eternal Son of God who came into our world for a purpose. And when he achieved that purpose, ascended back to the right hand of the Majesty on high. So first of all, what did Jesus know? Three things. Secondly, what Jesus did. He got up, took off his clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, poured water in a basin, and started to wash his disciples' feet. This was the lowest job an individual could do. If you had a subservient wife or a child, they might wash the feet of a house guest. But certainly the master never washed anyone's feet. And certainly no rabbi ever washed the feet of his disciples. We would say in modern language, the disciples are gobsmacked at what Jesus is doing. Why would he do this? You know, of course, in Israel, the roads are dust and you wear sandals. So whenever you enter the house, your feet were filthy. And you had a pot of water at the entrance to a home and you washed your own feet. But these are blokes. You know what blokes are like. Why wash your feet if you don't have to? There's no women present. We can do it tomorrow. So they just went in full of dirty feet. And they sat around. They were comfortable in their muck. Pigs in a mud bath. And yet their master was prepared to wash their... Why did he do it? Two reasons. First of all, because they were proud. Constantly arguing who was the best, who was the most important, who was the special one to Jesus. So that was one of the reasons. And secondly, their feet were dirty. Jesus saw a need and no one else would meet it, so he met it. And Jesus demonstrates for us humility. That's a badge, a mark of discipleship. Humility. And humility, there's three things as we finish to do with humility. Number one, humility makes no announcement. It just acts. Some churches actually have a foot washing ceremony. I've seen them advertised. I've never been to one, but I've seen them advertised. Foot washing ceremony this week. And do you know what everybody does before they go to that service? They wash the feet. Because you don't want to be the one with dirty feet. But that's the whole point. The whole point of washing somebody's feet is there was a need that needed to be met. If they all washed their own feet, Jesus would never have taken a towel and washed them. There was no point. But his act was unannounced. He didn't say, disciples, watch carefully, this is humility in action. Of course not. He just saw a need and he met it. What a contrast to the other religious. The other religious leaders on Jesus' day, everything they did was an outward show. Three times a day they stopped for prayer. They normally found a busy street corner. They lifted up their hands so you knew they were praying. They pulled up their, whatever you call it, I can't remember what it's called now, their prayer shawl, hands up, and they prayed as loud as they can. And everyone else who was busy doing stuff thought, cool, they're spiritual, aren't they? They're godly. Look what they're doing. When they put money in the collection, they didn't put it in. They got it and they flung it in so that the coins would hit the metal tin and rattle. And everyone would think, wow, look how much money they're putting into the copper coins. Everything they did was for show. And here's a rabbi who's the complete opposite. He just gently sees a need, without announcement, meets that need. Not only that, true humility... has no embarrassment. No embarrassment. He came to Simon Peter. Lord, you can't wash my feet. Simon was totally embarrassed, but not Jesus. He says, you're never going to wash my feet. Wash all of me then. And Jesus said, no, you don't need washing all of you. It's only your feet that are dirty. See, Simon saw Jesus as being weak. But he wasn't. He was meek. Weak is when you don't have power. Meekness is when you have power, but you control that power. A stallion can be meek when its rider has all the power of that animal under his control. And it is power that is useful rather than roaming wild. And Jesus demonstrates meekness, not weakness. That's why he wasn't embarrassed. But Peter saw it as weakness, and he was embarrassed. And then thirdly, humility shows no, or has no, favourites. It's not selective. Jesus washed Judas's feet as well as Peter. If I was Jesus, I'd have got cold water for Peter. And boiling water for Judas. You know, just to get even with them. That nasty, wake him up and sort him out. But he doesn't. No favouritism. He treats them all the same. Even though he knew Judas would betray him in a matter of hours. You know, there are no favourites with God. Sabrina isn't more loved of God because she's been baptized than someone who hasn't been baptized. God loves us all the same. His love is everlasting. It's constant. It doesn't go up and down like human emotions. Yes, we can please him. Yes, we can thrill him. But he still loves us. He doesn't have favorites. All of us are valuable. All of us are loved of God. And there's a punchline to this story. And it's in verse 17, the very last verse. And Jesus said, now that you know these things, you make sure you have regular Bible studies and talk about it. Now that you know these things, come along on a Sunday morning and wash each other's feet. No. Now that you know these things, blessed, happy many times over, if you do them. If you do them. In other words, if you see a need and you meet that need, God will bless you. So if someone needs a lift home, that's the equivalent of washing someone's feet. You say, well, I've got a space, jump in with me. Someone needs someone to go to the doctors with them. You say, well, I'll keep you company. I've got the time. I'll wash your feet. I'll help you. It's seeing a need and meeting it. That's the principle, said Jesus. That's a sign of discipleship. It's giving time to people. It's making effort with people. Even though they might say, well, I don't deserve it and I'm a bit embarrassed. No, I'll do it. It's an act of kindness. It's an act of love. And Jesus said, happy are you if you do it. Now, our time has gone. Thank you for your patience. And can I just say, on the table by where you'll get a drink in a minute, if you can stay for a drink, there's some little booklets called The Missing Piece. It explains what does it mean to actually be a Christian? How do you know if you're a Christian? How do you become a Christian? And what next? They're free of charge. If you'd like one, just next to the squash bottles. Do help yourself. And as you read it, I'm sure you'll find it helpful. In the hallway, there's some booklets called Believe and Be Baptised. And again, if you want to discover more about baptism, and some of the things I mentioned earlier, do help yourself to a copy. It's free of charge. Now we're going to conclude with our final song.